Well, it's raining outside, and I'm having a cup of tea. And interestingly, and this is not a coincidence at all, the book that I've got with me today is called The Book of Tea. It was written over 100 years ago in 1906 by Okakura Kakuzo. And as you can guess, he was a Japanese. And the book itself talks about the idea of tea and how that philosophy of teaism, as he calls it, it's relevant to the common man's life in Japanese culture, how it's a part of Japanese aesthetics, the art and literature, and at the same time, every citizen's life. And the way this book is written and narrated, it seems that the author is addressing Western audiences, and he's trying to introduce them to the Japanese culture. And when he talks about teaism, he brings in all the philosophy of the East, whether it's the Indian or the Chinese or Japanese. And surely, he sticks with the Japanese one for most of the time in this book, but he gives you this basic understanding of the Eastern cultures and how what we call meditation or philosophy, spirituality, it's a part of everyday life in Eastern cultures. So, through tea, in fact, through the smallest of things, as the author says, we can understand the larger aspects of life. And this was the idea that I particularly enjoyed. In fact, I feel this is how one should enjoy the tea. In fact, everything, every little thing that you do. So I would insist, and generally I don't. In this case, I insist you to read the book, especially if you are a tea lover. And in this podcast, I'm going to read certain pages from the book, which will give you some idea about what this book is all about and what is the author trying to tell you or show you through this book. So let's start. Tea is a work of art and needs a master hand to bring out its noblest qualities. We have good and bad tea, as we have good and bad paintings, generally the latter. There is no single recipe for making the perfect tea, as there are no rules for producing a Titian or a Sesson. Each preparation of the leaves has its individuality, its special affinity with water and heat, its own method of telling a story. The truly beautiful must always be in it. How much do we not suffer through the constant failure of society to recognize this simple and fundamental law of art and life? Lichilai, a Sung poet, has sadly remarked that there were three most deplorable things in the world: the spoiling of fine youths through false education, the degradation of fine art through vulgar admiration, and the utter waste of fine tea through incompetent manipulation. Like art, tea has its periods and its schools. Its evolution may be roughly divided into three main stages: the boiled tea, the whipped tea, and the steeped tea. We moderns belong to the last school. These several methods of appreciating the beverage are indicative of the spirit of the age in which they prevailed. For life is an expression, our unconscious actions the constant betrayal of our innermost thought. Confucius said that man hides not. Perhaps we reveal ourselves too much in small things because we have so little of the great to conceal. The tiny incidents of daily routine are as much a commentary of racial ideals as the highest flight of philosophy or poetry. Even as the difference in favorite vintage marks the separate idiosyncrasies of different periods and nationalities of Europe, so the tea ideals characterize the various moods of Oriental culture. The cake tea which was boiled, the powdered tea which was whipped, the leaf tea which was steeped, mark the distinct emotional impulses of the Tang, the Song, and the Ming dynasties of China. If we were inclined to borrow the much abused terminology of art classification, we might designate them respectively: the classic, the romantic, and the naturalistic schools of tea. The tea plant, a native of southern China, was known from very early times to Chinese botany and medicine. It is alluded to in the classics under the various names of Tao, Se, Chung, Ha, and Ming, and was highly prized for possessing the virtues of relieving fatigue, delighting the soul, strengthening the will, and repairing the eyesight. It was not only administered as an internal dose, but often applied externally in form of paste to alleviate rheumatic pains. The Taoists claimed it as an important ingredient of the elixir of immortality. The Buddhists used it extensively to prevent drowsiness during their long hours of meditation. By the 4th and 5th centuries, tea became a favorite beverage among the inhabitants of the Yangtze Kiang Valley. It was about this time that every modern knows the word cha. It was coined evidently as a corruption of the classic Tao. The poets of the southern dynasties have left some fragments of their fervent adoration of the froth of the liquid jade. Then emperors used to bestow some rare preparation of the leaves on their high ministers as a reward for eminent services. Yet the method of drinking tea at this stage was primitive in the extreme. The leaves were steamed, crushed in a mortar, made into a cake, and boiled together with rice, ginger, salt, orange peel, spices, milk, and sometimes with onions. The custom obtains at the present day among the Tibetans and various Mongolian tribes who make a curious syrup of these ingredients. The use of lemon slices by the Russians who learned to take tea from the Chinese points to the survival of the ancient method. It needed the genius of the Tang dynasty to emancipate tea from its crude state and lead to its final idealization. With Lu Wu in the middle of the 8th century, we have our first apostle of tea. He was born in an age when Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism were seeking mutual synthesis. The pantheistic symbolism of the time was urging one to mirror the universal in the particular. Lu Wu, a poet, saw in the tea service the same harmony and order which reigned through all things. In his celebrated work, The Cha King, he formulated the code of tea. He has been worshipped as the tutelary god of the Chinese tea merchants. The Cha King consists of 3 volumes and 10 chapters. In the first chapter, Lu Wu treats of the nature of the tea plant. In the second, of the implements for gathering the leaves. In the third, of the selection of the leaves. According to him, the best quality of the leaves must have creases like the leathern boot of Tatar horsemen, curl like the dewlap of a mighty bullock, unfold like a mist rising out of a ravine, gleam like a lake touched by a zephyr, and be wet and soft like fine earth newly swept by rain. The fourth chapter is devoted to the enumeration and description of the 24 members of the tree equipage, beginning with the tripod brazier and ending with the bamboo cabinet for containing all these utensils. Here we notice Lu Wu's predilection for Taoist symbolism. Also, it is interesting to observe in this connection the influence of tea on Chinese ceramics. The celestial porcelain, all is well known, had its origin in an attempt to reproduce the exquisite shade of jade, resulting in the Tang dynasty in the blue glaze of the south and the white glaze of the north. Lu Wu considered the blue as the ideal color for the teacup, as it lent additional greenness to the beverage, whereas the white made it look pinkish and distasteful. It was because he used cake tea. Later on, when the tea masters of Sung took to the powder tea, they preferred heavy bowls of blue-black and dark brown. The Mings, with their steeped tea, rejoiced in light ware of white porcelain. In the fifth chapter, Lu Wu describes the method of making tea. He eliminates all ingredients except salt. He dwells also on the much-discussed question of the choice of water and the degree of boiling it. According to him, the mountain spring is the best. The river water and the spring water come next in the order of excellence. There are three stages of boiling. The first boil is when the little bubbles like the eyes of fishes swim on the surface. The second boil is when the bubbles are like crystal beads rolling in a fountain. The third boil is when the billows surge wildly in the kettle. The cake tea is roasted before the fire until it becomes soft like a baby's arm and is shredded into powder between pieces of fine paper. Salt is put in the first boil, the tea in the second. At the third boil, a dipperful of cold water is poured into the kettle to settle the tea and revive the youth of the water. Then the beverage was poured into cups and drunk. O nectar! The filmy leaflet hung like scaly clouds in a serene sky or floated like water lilies or emerald streams. It was of such a beverage that Lo Tung, a Tang poet, wrote, "The first cup moistens my lips and throat. The second cup breaks my loneliness. The third cup searches my barren entrail but to find therein some 5,000 volumes of odd ideographs. The fourth cup raises a slight perspiration. All the wrong of life passes away through my pores. At the fifth cup, I am purified. The sixth cup calls me to the realms of the immortals. The seventh cup, but I could take no more. I only feel the breath of cool wind that rises in my sleeves. Where is horizon? Let me ride on this sweet breeze and waft away tithar." The remaining chapters of the Cha King treat of the vulgarity of the ordinary methods of tea drinking. A historical summary of illustrious tea drinkers, the famous tea plantations of China, the possible variations of the tea service, and illustrations of the tea utensils. The last is unfortunately lost. The appearance of the Cha King must have created considerable sensation at the time. Lu Wu was befriended by the Emperor Taizong, and his fame attracted many followers. Some exquisites were said to have been able to detect the tea made by Lu Wu from that of his disciples.